go inside the city and breach the first walls, and you'll find certain other important areas have other walls around them. In the neighborhood where the temple was being rebuilt, where the king's palace used to be, that would have its own walls that were also broken down from the captivity. So what's happening is, Jerusalem, none of those walls are rebuilt. They got to build at least a wall around the area that they're occupying in what is their new Jerusalem area. But no one's done it. In fact, 150 years after the city was destroyed, there was still no wall protecting any part of it. And for over half that time, the Jews have come back and have rebuilt and settled in that section, but still no wall protected them. And they couldn't build a wall to stop Persia or someday stop Alexander the Great. They didn't have the capacity to build a wall to stop an empire at this point. But they could build a wall that would stop raiding bands of marauders or thieves or enemies around them. With no wall, you're vulnerable. They had to get something, but they never did. They never could. It was too much of a mess, too much rubble, too much undertaking to even build that wall. And so it sat there unoccupied. And that's where we meet our new character named Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a man who lives back in Persia. He did not come to Jerusalem with everybody else. He did not come with his family and other relatives who came back to Jerusalem all those years ago. He stayed in Persia in the capital city of Susa because he had a pretty interesting job. He was the cupbearer for the king of Persia. Now, a cupbearer is a very important job. It was a person who would deliver everything the king would ever drink from his royal goblet or whatever. It was always handled by the cupbearer. And one of the cupbearer's jobs was to taste test what the king would be given before it was given to the king. And then after a few minutes, if the cupbearer didn't fall over dead, you know, the king was safe to drink it because there were people who were trying to assassinate the king. So the cupbearer was kind of sort of a first step in making sure that the king would not get poisoned. That sounds like a dangerous job in a way, doesn't it? But actually, it wasn't that dangerous because people knew there was a cupbearer. Therefore, there was no real attempt to try to poison the king that way very often because it would get found. So by having a cupbearer, it made it pretty safe. So Nehemiah had a pretty sweet gig. That's why he stayed in Persia. That's why he lived in the palace. He was close, trusted, confidant of the king. He had access to the best food in the land, the best city to live in. And he stayed there. But one day, his brother and his brother's family came back from Jerusalem all the way to Susa to visit him. And while they're visiting, he asks them, how are things going back home? And they're going to tell him. Now, before I get into the story, I want to tell you, I'm going to spoil the end surprise here. Nehemiah is going to end up being responsible for getting that wall rebuilt around Jerusalem, at least the part of Jerusalem that they had reoccupied. He's going to get that wall built. And that's a big undertaking. It's huge. So huge that no one has done it in the past 150 years, but he'll get it done. And so as we read the story today, I want us to see how does a great work get done. We'll find that out because Nehemiah does it, and we'll see 10 principles in the story that we won't necessarily stop and point out, but if you're listening, you'll catch them as we go. And at the end, we'll review these ways, these important steps for a great work to get done. And so we've got a lot of ground to cover. I don't have time to teach the whole book of Nehemiah. There's 13 chapters. Some of it's political. I'm going to skip that. Some of it's Nehemiah's little cray-cray at the end of his story. We'll skip all that. But early on, the first part of the first six chapters is him leading the initiative to rebuild the wall. That is what he's famous for. That's what we'll study today. If you want the rest of the story, do what we want you to do. Go home and read it for yourself. That's the whole idea. We'll give you some information. Hopefully some insight. So today, Nehemiah's brother is visiting with his family. He asks them, how are things going back in Jerusalem? And here's what they tell Nehemiah in chapter 1, verse 3. They said to me, things are not going well for those who have returned to the province of Judah. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem has been torn down, and the gates have been destroyed by fire. Basically, he's told what we were already talking about. It's bad over there. Look at his response in verse 4. When I heard this, I sat down and wept. In fact, I mourned. And he didn't just sit down and weep one time like, whoa, I need to have a seat and cry. He wept for days, it says. For days I mourned, and fasted and prayed. So this didn't let him go. This wasn't one of those passing sad moments. This thing gets a hold of him and won't let go. It's a burden that I think God must have given him, right? A burden that God must have given him to do something important, and it won't let go. So days turn into weeks. Notice the burden. Notice also that he prayed. Sometimes they're like, I don't have time to pray. I'm busy doing my job. I got all these problems stressing me out. But he said, God, I need your help. He fasted and he prayed because he knew how important that was. Well, here's the problem. He's the king's cupbearer. You had to go into the king happy. The king wanted a happy and beautiful environment. The king is always dead. You know, the king wants to live in a city that is immaculate and the decorations around him that are ornate and beautiful. He wants beautiful buildings. He wants attractive people. He wants intelligent people. And he wants happy people because he wants to feel like his life is, he's in a good spot. If you got to tell the king some bad news, he's like, maybe you can tell me the bad news in a good way, right? And it don't seem so bad. It's a reference to something. But maybe you can just, you know, be happy around me, he says. So Nehemiah's job was to put on this happy face, but he has this burden. He's been weeping, he's been praying. And one day he forgets to put on the smile. Verse 2 of chapter 2, so the king asked me, why are you looking so sad? You don't look sick to me. You must be deeply troubled. He's in trouble. He might knew he blew it right away. Verse 2b says, then I was terrified. But I replied, long live the king. It's not about you, sir. Long live the king. It's not like I have some plot against you that I'm a scared of. I know. We're great. And he just comes clean. He just says, I might as well come clean. Otherwise, he says, how can I not be saved? For the city where my ancestors are buried is in ruins. And the gates have been destroyed by fire. And then something very unexpected happens. In verse 4, the king asked, well, how can I help you?
Nehemiah did not walk into the shop that day expecting that. He didn't come in expecting to tell his why he was sad. That was an accident. And he surely didn't expect the king to say, how can I help you? Like, whoa. Like, that was an open door that just happened. And Nehemiah saw an opportunity, and he was not going to pass it up. So he seized it. He says in verse 4, with a prayer to the God of heaven, I replied, if it please the king, and if you are pleased with me, your servant, send me to Judah to rebuild the city where my ancestors are buried. Like, let me go home. Now, that's a dangerous request. First, for one, the king does not want to lose a trusted cupbearer. You know, you'll have a few of those maybe taking turns. It's a very tight circle. You've got to replace him if he's gone. Also, Nehemiah is living a pretty sweet gig. That's why he stayed there all this time. But he says, I want to go back. I want to leave this behind, knowing that I might lose my job and it may never be waiting for me someday. And I don't know how things will go there, but I feel like I'd like to go back and do this job. And the king surprisingly says yes. In fact, he empowers him. King of Persia makes Nehemiah the governor of Jerusalem. There were other regional powers in that area over all of them, but of the city of Jerusalem that he was returning to, he made him governor. And that was a big deal because Persia ruled over all that land, and with his backing, Nehemiah walked in with authority to a place he was just walking into. And that empowered him to get funds and money and authority to get a job done. And the king told him, I want you to come back one day. It's hard to say. He's gone for a number of years, and it could be in two different shifts. I won't get into that. Bottom line, he says, you can go and come back someday and have your old job back. So Nehemiah went from Persia to Jerusalem. In chapter 2, verse 11, it says, so I arrived in Jerusalem. 3 days later, I slipped out during the night, taking only a few others with me. Now, notice what happens. When he gets to the city, he doesn't say anything. We're going to see that momentarily. He waits. He spends the first 3 days recovering from his trip, getting to know who's who, right? Who's in charge around here, getting to meet people, figure out what's going on. And then one night after 3 days of being there, he slips out while everyone else is in bed, you know, settling down or watching Netflix before they fall asleep. He sneaks out with a few others with him, and he goes throughout the city to beyond what they've repaired and lived in, to see where the wall was broken down, to go beyond that wall to the rest of the city that was still in shambles, to that wall, and notice how bad it was throughout Jerusalem. It says in the next verse, I had not told anyone about the plans that God had put in my heart for Jerusalem. We took no pack animals with us except the donkey I was riding. No one knew why he was there yet. Because he didn't want to come in all half-cocked and saying, I'm here to do something. And they're like, who are you, man? We even know you. He figured I better show up, not just with a title and a position, but better meet the people, keep quiet, check out the land, and know what I'm talking about. Finally, he meets with all the officials in the city. And in chapter 2, verse 17, he says to them, you know very well what trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and end this disgrace. Then I told them about how the gracious hand of God had been on me and about my conversation with the king, and they replied at once, yes, let's rebuild the wall. So they began the good work. Now, it's beautiful. Once he shares his vision with everybody, they're so excited to hear what he wanted to do, how the story of how the king endorsed it. It gave him momentum. Everyone's excited to hear this. They knew they needed a wall built. Now someone's got a plan. He's going to involve them all. They're like, let's do it. And they begin the work. Well, I want to remind you, I've tried to say this already. This is not, archaeology and history teaches us, though some of us may not think about this if we have a long church background, but history shows us this was not the entire former city of Jerusalem. This is just the part that they are now, the new entire city, which is where they're occupying as people. And the wall that they're going to build is not going to be as fancy as that former wall that David and Solomon and all those folks had built a long time ago, right? They don't have the manpower. They don't have the money. They're building something. It's not going to be necessarily pretty. In fact, sometimes it's going to be over piles of rubble that are hard to move. Other times it's going to be on the ground. Sometimes they're going to repair certain sections that have been torn down. Just, they need a little repair. Other times they're going to need to be completely rebuilt from the ground up. Sometimes you got to be careful where gates are going in so that things will be sturdy during weather changes. But other times you just got to do what you got to do. It won't be magnificent. It certainly won't be strong enough to keep out the Persian war machine. Or the future Alexander the Greats from roll over them, but it can keep out local threats and make them safe from bands of thieves and marauders. And they need one. And so they get building. They get about halfway done, but they run into some trouble. Verse 7 says, but when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the work was going ahead and that the gaps in the wall of Jerusalem were being repaired, they were furious. Now, this is a nerdy detail, so if you don't care, forgive me. But for the nerds among us, Sanballat and Tobiah were names not just of people, they were titles. I've said many times before, there are certain positions that have titles that multiple people hold, like the Caesar and Pharaoh and Herod and Darius. And there were the Sanballats, were many different people who took that title. The Tobiahs were another group. They were part of the Jewish mixed with the non-Jewish people up north who converted to Yahwism or Yahweh worship and had their own temple, their own political machinations for Israel. And they were among them. And these political enemies, along with all the Arabs and others around them, well, they got together and said, we're not happy to hear Jerusalem's being rebuilt. Because Jerusalem was this little burned, torn down city that was a political threat to their aspirations. And people were living there for decades, but they were vulnerable with no wall. But if a wall goes up, that kind of makes them legitimate, and we don't want that. So they're furious. It says in verse number 8, they all made plans to come and fight against Jerusalem and throw us into confusion. But we prayed to our God and guarded the city day and night to protect ourselves. Now that's the backstory. Here's the details of how that goes down. Verse 10, then the people of Judah began to complain. The workers are getting tired, and there is so much rubble to be moved. We'll never be able to build the wall by ourselves. Y'all know what's happening, don't you? It was a great idea at first, right? Everyone's excited about the new project. Everyone's pumped. But then what happens when good ideas come along and everyone gets inspired? What happens over time? The newness wears off. It just gets hard. They're like, well, I'll never get this wall built. You know, they're all discouraged. On top of that, it says, meanwhile, our enemies were saying, before they know what's happening, we will swoop down on them and kill them and end their work. I mean, they made plans with all these people who didn't even get along politically, conspired together to form enough of a group that probably can't on their own take out Jerusalem once the wall's finished. But maybe while the wall's still being done, they can get in there and kill them and stop their work. So the Jews who lived near the enemy came and told us again and again, they'll come from all directions and attack us. What do you do in a moment like that? Verse 13, so I placed armed guards behind the lowest parts of the walls in the exposed areas. I stationed the people to stand guard by families, armed with swords, spears, and bows. And of course, by doing that, the enemy who planned to attack them thought they could surprise them when they needed to surprise them because it'd be too hard and too bloody and get back to Persia. They needed it to be quick and surprising. But now that they were on guard, the plan was spoiled. In verse 15 says, when our enemies heard that we knew of their plans and that God had frustrated their plans, we all returned to our work on the wall. But let's be honest, how do you ever go back to rebuilding the wall, right? Without thinking, what if they come back? I'm sure there were people saying, Nehemiah, we got to stay on guard duty. We got to stay with our weapons in hand. They'll kill us. And what are you supposed to do? Nehemiah says, we got to build the wall. If we stop building the wall to get ready to fight, the wall's not getting built. That's what I came here to do. But if I build the wall without protecting ourselves, we're going to get killed anyhow, which will defeat the purpose. And so this is the kind of moment where you're stuck in a quandary, and Nehemiah decides to get creative. He says in verse number 16, from then on, only half my men worked while the other half stood guard with spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. It refers to a body armor called chain mail. You've heard of that before. They stayed ready for war. The leaders stationed themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the wall. The laborers carried on their work with one hand supporting their load and one hand holding a weapon. Now, understanding and studying this, what it seems to reply is besides the nighttime guards, during the daytime, half the people would take turns just not working on the wall and being unready, weapons in hand. The other half would work on the wall, but keep their weapon handy. I don't know if it really means in their hand, like it seems to say, or more as on hand, so to speak. So they wouldn't have to go put their work down and run to find it if a war came in. They were ready to jump in to fight at a moment's notice, but they kept building anyway. It says in verse 21, we worked early and late, from sunrise to sunset, and half the men were always on guard. I also told everyone living outside the walls to stay in Jerusalem. That way they and their servants could help with guard duty at night and work during the day. During this time, none of us, not I, nor my relatives, nor my servants, nor the guards who were with me, ever took off our clothes. Gross. Okay. We carried our weapons with us at all times, even when we went for water or whatever, I'm sure. This is a time you just gotta stay on guard. Well, that's a creative way that Nehemiah found a way to both address the problem and build the wall. Instead of saying, which do we do? Let's do both. Let's do both. It's important. It's an important thing. But there's one other obstacle that pops up that threatens to stop the work besides the outside enemy. It's an internal problem that Nehemiah did not see coming. And I wanted to skip it for today for sake of time, but it's just too important. So let me tell you the story. Way before Nehemiah had ever arrived to do this project, there was a lot of bad stuff going on. For the last many decades, Jews who had come back to this area were of different economic statuses. Some were well off, some were not well off. Some were rich, some were poor. And the problem was, when you came back to this land, you could occupy your old ancestral lands, but you're a part of a greater area that was referred to as the Levant, that was under the rule of Persia. And they expected taxes from those lands to show their homage to Persia. So the regional leaders over places like Jerusalem collected those taxes and a little bit extra, because you know how taxes work, right? A little bit extra to take what they needed to send back to Persia what they wanted and also to enrich themselves. So it was hard to pay those dues. And the poor people who came back from Jerusalem area to their lands eventually had to sell their lands to the wealthier Jewish brothers and sisters. So they get money to pay their taxes and be able to eat. But eventually that put them in a bigger hole because now they got to rent their land and work it and give some of that away and still pay taxes and eat. And that put them in, they had to borrow money. They went into debt. And eventually in those days, if you were in debt and couldn't pay it, they could take your family into debtor's slavery. People were having their kids and their family taken from them into slavery. Well, they worked hard to catch up on their bills, but it was an impossible feat. And because they had to sell their stuff to the wealthier Jews among them, the rich got richer while the poor got poorer. And as we've seen so many times in the world, the wealth-income gap spread further and further apart. That's what's going on. And so, this has been going on before Nehemiah arrives. He's just trying to build a wall, because they need a wall, but now this boils over. I don't know if people had showed up and caused trouble right then, but all of a sudden, people are frustrated, and they're shutting down. And they come to Nehemiah to complain. We see the story starting in Nehemiah 5, verse 5. They said, "We belong to the same family as those who are wealthy, and our children are just like theirs, yet we must sell our children into slavery just to get enough money to live. We have already sold some of our daughters, and we are helpless to do anything about it." Yikes. It's terrible. "For our fields and our vineyards are already mortgaged to others." Like, we are, there's no way forward for us, man. Of course, Nehemiah doesn't know this. He's finding out on the spot while he's trying to get this work done, and he's not happy. In verse 6, he says, "When I heard their complaints, I was angry, very angry." Now, that's not shocking. If you read the whole story of Nehemiah, he was an angry man at times. In fact, Nehemiah was a very passionate individual. That's why he cried when he first heard about the wall being torn down. That's why he had this passion point to rebuild. He also had anger things. You can see the later chapters. He's a whole character before it's over. But he's righteously angry. He's rightly angry right now. He calls together all the wealthy who've taken advantage and gotten richer on the backs of the poor people among them. He calls them together for a meeting. Verse 8, "At the meeting I said to them, 'We are doing all we can to redeem our Jewish relatives who've had to sell themselves to pagan foreigners. But you're selling them back into slavery again. How often must we redeem them?' And they had nothing to say in their defense." See, as usual, the powerful, the poor don't have a voice, the powerful did. But now Nehemiah comes in a government position, and he has the power to say something to the powerful, and because he's got a good heart, the poor have an advocate in a position of authority to speak to the ones who were abusing them. And so Nehemiah pressed further, verse 9, "Then I pressed further, 'What you are doing is not right. Should you not walk in the fear of our God in order to avoid being mocked by enemy nations?'" He calls them out. And amazingly, they listen. They comply with Nehemiah's demand. I don't know how often you would see people in power and in wealth fight for their right to keep doing what they're doing. But they listened to Nehemiah. Maybe it was because of his example. Maybe it was because it was his persuasion. Probably because of his position and his power. They gave the land back to the poor people that they got it from. They gave some of their money back to them. They righted the ship and brought equity amongst the people of Jerusalem and saved the day from it being a disaster. And maybe the reason why Nehemiah, besides the fact that he was the governor, maybe the reason why he could pull this off is because he didn't just talk the talk. He walked the walk. I want you to see this with me. In verse 14, he says, "For the entire 12 years that I was governor of Judah, from the 20th to the 32nd year of the reign of King Artaxerxes, neither I nor my officials drew our official food allowance." He didn't take a paycheck. For the entire time that he was the governor, he had rights that came to him that he could collect like all the other powerful people did. But he said, no, no. Now, he says, "We got something to do. And that's why he led by example in this way. In fact, he goes on and says in verse 16, "I also devoted myself to working on the wall and refused to acquire any land. And I required all my servants to spend time working on the wall." Here's what's interesting. Nehemiah, don't misunderstand. Nehemiah didn't have a problem with getting well off for himself. Before he came here, he had a pretty good job in Susa that he stayed behind before this to do in the past years. And he'll go back again, and in later parts of his life, he can acquire all sorts of financial compensation. But right now, he's trying to get something done. And during this time, he can't do this And he said everyone else to treat others right while he takes advantage of the system. And so he makes the sacrifice to lead by example. But Nehemiah, you deserve it. I know. But instead he prays to God. In verse 19, he says this, "Remember, oh my God, all I've done for these people, and bless me for it. God, you can pay me back. You can take care of me." Well, at some point, the wall's getting far along, and the people who are his opponents on the outside, who are trying to stop him, begin to change their tactics. They begin to say, you know, maybe we can't stop him. Maybe if you can't beat them, you can join them. So they begin to say to Nehemiah, hey, why don't you come meet us over in this other city here? We'll all come to a neutral spot and put some plans to work together on some bigger initiatives. And by the way, they may have had foul intentions at heart, but maybe they didn't, according to the invitation. Who knows, right? Nehemiah has his suspicions, but here's the bottom line. This was going to legitimize Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a nothing burger all these years. And people were trying to rally the community and the whole region to work together for greater purposes. And Jerusalem was on the outside for political reasons. And now that they've built this wall, the enemy's saying, hey, come be a part with us. Let's do some stuff together. And Nehemiah could have said, that'd be great for me as a governor. That'd be great for Jerusalem to become important. But he knew that they had a job to do. And so Nehemiah in chapter 6, verse 3, so I replied by sending this message to them. I am engaged in a great work, so I can't come. Why should I stop working to come and meet with you? He's like, listen, guys, it sounds great, but I'm doing something great. And if I'm not doing this because I'm doing that, this slows down. This is what I came to do. I'm doing a great work. I can't come. Sorry. He said no. Well, that did not make them happy. So then they became enemies again. And then they began to spread gossip, listen carefully, gossip and rumors about Nehemiah. They began to spread the rumor that Nehemiah was trying to build the city walls to make himself the king, to rebel against the king of Persia. And that kind of rumor was not just mean. It could have gotten Nehemiah in trouble with Persia. It could have been bad news for him. And Nehemiah has to, what does he do? Does he stop and run after? Does he stop what he's doing and deal with this person who said these things to him? Is he trying to put out all the fires of gossip? No. He simply says in verse 8, I replied, there is no truth in any part of your story. You're making up the whole thing. He said, they were just trying to intimidate us, imagining that they could discourage us and stop the work. So I continued the work with even greater determination. You can say what you want to say. I'll let my work speak for me. I ain't got time to deal with the gossip. Well, then they tried something else. Someone who worked inside the temple in Jerusalem was connected to the people outside, and they came to Nehemiah and said, Nehemiah, there's an assassination attempt on your life going to go down. You don't want to die. Come inside the temple with us. Let's lock the doors and hide inside the temple so you don't get killed because they're coming to assassinate you. Come hide with us. We'll keep you safe for a while. But Nehemiah replied in verse 11, should someone in my position run from danger? Should someone in my position enter the temple to save his life? No, I won't do it. I realized that God had not spoken to him, but he had uttered this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. They were hoping to intimidate me and make me sin, and then they would be able to accuse and discredit me. He said, if I am not out with the people getting the job done, they won't be inspired. They'll wonder where I'm at. I'll look weak. Our cause will look fearful. I can't do that. I've got to stay in the public eye and risk it. I can't go hide. And finally, through his determination and lack of persuasion otherwise, and through all the obstacles they faced internally and externally, they finished the job. And Nehemiah 6:15 says, so on October 2nd, the wall was finished. By the way, that's the beginning of October. That's where we are right now, beginning of October, right now, right? October 2nd, the wall was finished just 52 days after we had begun. Now again, this is not, for the third time, the whole former city of the fortress days of David and Solomon. This is the entire city as it is now, rebuilt in that area where the temple's rebuilt. It's big still. It's very big. It's a big place. And they had to repair some, completely rebuild others, work around damage. It was hard. But folks, 52 days! That's like, okay, if October 2nd, I didn't do the math officially, that's somewhere in early August that they would have started, according to that mark. Oh, well, that's about. That's remarkable. Especially when the job had not even been done over the past 150 years. It was important, but it was overwhelming. And they get it done. That's pretty cool. And that's where we're going to stop our story today. If you want to read more of Nehemiah, I hope you do. Read the whole book. It's there for your reading. A lot happens. He works with Ezra that we met last week. They do a census. They have a festival. They have a confession time before God over past and present sins. They make a covenant with God. They move more people in the city. Nehemiah goes back to Susa in Persia, returns later as governor. Kind of seems like he loses his composure a little bit and is like a hothead fighting for political frustrations. In the end of his story, you can read those for yourself. But this was the main thing about the story. He rebuilt the wall. Now, next week, I'm gonna come back and we're gonna wrap up by talking about the lessons from the story. Before I do, next week, we're gonna start our very last story in the Old Testament journey. It's been a long journey, hasn't it? Last story. It's gonna take us 2 weeks to tell it. Not because it's so long, maybe even shorter than Nehemiah in many ways. But because it's so good, we don't want to rush through. There's so many things to see and learn. In fact, it's a story that happened before today's story happened, a story that made today's story possible. And the story next week does not happen in Jerusalem. It happens in a far-off city in a far-off land. And it's so epic and beautiful. It's a great way to end our Old Testament series. So don't miss that next week. For today, we saw an amazing thing accomplished. And I want us to wrap up by going back to the story and asking ourselves a question. How do great works get done? Because that's what they did. Nehemiah did a great, he said, I'm doing a great work. How do great works get done? It's not easy. If it was easy, everyone would do it. If it was easy, Nehemiah wouldn't have had to do what he did. And I want to say this because I want us to think about our own lives for a minute. Maybe there's something in your life that you feel God has put in your life or your heart. Maybe it's something you're supposed to do. It's a career, a business mover, an entrepreneur mover to start something. Or maybe it's a side passion or a side hustle or a side idea. Maybe it's a spiritual thing that you're supposed to start doing in your faith journey. It could be anything. I don't want to put boundaries around it. But if you ever want to do something that God is moving you to do and it's great, it's probably hard. Otherwise, everyone will be doing it. And whatever that might look like for you and your family and your home and your relationships and your world and your bigger dreams, it doesn't matter what it is. The question is, how do great works get done? And maybe we can look at those principles Nehemiah saw and find something in there that speaks to us as well. And so I want to glance back at real fast. We saw 10 principles of how great works get done. First one is this. First, you discover your burden. You got to discover your burden. I don't mean something makes you sad one day. Nehemiah didn't just get over, hear the sad news, cry, and then move on. Lots of things come into our lives that can make us feel bad for a few minutes, and then we finally get over it. Lots of things that impact us for a day or so, and then we move on. But when something gets a hold of your heart, something you can't let go of, something that won't go away, that you lose sleep and thought and process, and you dream about it, and you pine away over, that may be a burden that God is putting there, a passion God is putting there. Discover your burden. If God's given you one, don't neglect it. Maybe he's doing something. Number two, pray for direction and help. I know we get busy. I don't have time for that. I got to do all these things. Nehemiah said, God, I need to know. We need to go to God and say, God, here I am. Is this from you or is this me? If it is from you, help me or guide me. I need some, but I don't care where your spiritual journey is in your personal life right now. We all need divine help if we're going to do a great work in our lives, in your life. How do great works get done? Number three, yes, seize the moment. Nehemiah was like, how can I help you? The king said. And he's like, whoa, open door, grab. See, sometimes we get so paralyzed by fear. I'm afraid that if I step out to do something, something's going to go wrong. What if, what if, what if, what if? And so we hesitate in fear, and we never step out and seize the moment, and then the moment passes. If a great work is going to get done, sometimes you've got to seize the moment when it comes. Number four is going to sound like a contradiction to number three. I want to tie them together. They seem like opposite sides, but they're the same coin. Number four is this, gather facts. When Nehemiah got to Jerusalem, he didn't just run off and tell everybody what he was there to do. He listened, he watched, he saw who was who. He went around the city at night by himself. He got his ducks in a row. I'm the boss, do what I say. Who are you? No, I know what's up. You got to gather facts, because otherwise you're going to not consider the cost and get stuck halfway through and say, man, I didn't even think this through very well. Now, here's the thing. Those might sound contradictory. You're like, Arlen, I can't seize the moment because I'm busy gathering facts because I'm a person who wants all my ducks in a row. And others are like, Arlen, I can't gather facts. I got to seize the moment. And that's probably personality right there. The risk-averse among us love the gather facts point. And the wild cowboys and yahoos among us love to seize the moment. All right? And so the risk-averse are like, that's right, tell those everyone else they should gather more facts and just wait. And then the crazy half-cocked, deranged psychos like me, seize the moment! And maybe we should gather. Tell everyone to seize the moment. Maybe you should get some facts. It's not an either-or. It's both. You have to find out where your tendency is and fight against it. Maybe someone else needs to start seizing the moment and start doing something, man. Stop letting fear of all the what-ifs stop you. And all those of us need to maybe you do a little research on what God's calling us to do. They're both important to get a great work done. Number five, share your vision. You got to share it. Nehemiah told everyone what God was doing. He told them some stories that inspired them. His ideas inspired them to want to be a part, and he invited them into working with him. Because no matter how much some of us want to be independent, self-built, self-whatever people, we were not meant to do this alone. We were not made to do this alone. God wants us to team up, to do great things. And if you've got to put something great in your heart, share your vision. Invite others into it. Speak about it. Put yourself in that space. How do great works get done? We've done five. We have five to go. We're halfway done. How do great works get done? Number six, turn your either or into a yes and. Boy, Nehemiah, we got to stop building to prepare for battle training. No, we got to keep building. Well, if we keep building and we die, we're done anyhow. Well, if we prepare for battle, we don't build, we're done anyhow. So many of us, here's what happens to us. You ever do something important and you're going along and then obstacles out of nowhere show up and you're like, oh, I guess I can't do it anymore, and we want to quit. And sometimes you can't ignore a problem because it's too big to ignore, but it's not an either or, it's a both and. And you got to get creative and you got to find a way to say, I got to do this and that. Some things can be ignored, some things can't. The people who are upset about the poverty, they needed Nehemiah to do something. You got to do both. And sometimes if you're going to get your work done and something has to be addressed, you got to figure out how to do a yes and instead of an either or. The next point will sound like a contradiction. It's not. It's the other side of the same coin. The next point is this. Know when to say no. You're like, I thought it was yes and. No. Sometimes it has to be yes and. Sometimes it's too important. You can't ignore the people who are being... Nehemiah couldn't ignore the people who were being taken into debtor slavery and mistreated by the richer. He could ignore the enemy marching against them. That's where you got to turn either or into yes and. But sometimes there's opportunities that you can say no to. For example, hey, come meet us over here. Let's do something extra cool. Maybe that's awesome. You know, when you're trying to do something great, you know, one of the most important words you need to get a great work done is focus. And sometimes it's less about saying yes and more about saying no. And saying no is hard, hard, hard. But there's always so many opportunities you can't do everything. And if you're not careful, you'll do so much, you'll stretch thin and get nothing done. When you're called to do a great work, sometimes you got to say no to good things so you can say yes to the best things. And no doesn't always mean no forever. Sometimes no means no for now. No for this season of my life, no. But not no forever. You got to know when to say no to good things to get the best things done. How do great works get done? Number eight, be willing to sacrifice. Nehemiah didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk. It's hard. If you believe in something, you'll have to make sacrifices. You won't get it done without sacrifice, and you won't inspire anyone else to get it done with you if you're not willing to sacrifice. At some point, for that season of your life, in some way, you might have to sit there and say, to get this done, there has to be sacrifice. How do great works get done? Number nine, you have to ignore the noise. They were gossiping about Nehemiah, spreading rumors. You know what happens to us, don't we? Someone says something mean to us, we want to stop everything we're doing and just focus on that and deal with that. And it's like, does it need to be dealt with? Or the gossip that goes, I want to go put all the little fires out, rally our little circle of support, and just it overtakes our life and our focus and our energy. You got to learn to ignore the noise. It's always going to be noise. Can I give you a little secret to life that you probably know, but we should point out? The more visible you become in the world, you'll have more lovers and more haters. As soon as you start doing something that's noticeable and you start doing something that's significant, people start noticing something you're doing, you'll gain more supporters and detractors. It's how it is. You're going to get both lovers and haters. It's just how it's going to go. The bigger it is. Unless you're, if you're a hermit on the mountain, living on a mountain by yourself in a cave, you may have neither. But the more you get out there, you're going to get haters and lovers, supporters and detractors. And if you let the noise distract you, so you have to put out all the fires and address all the critics instead of ignoring it, you'll always stop. Because the critics are always going to be there. And the people they criticize you to are going to figure it out and say, that's not true. Or they're going to maybe get tripped up by it for a moment, then they'll figure it out later. Do what Nehemiah did. Say, I'm going to let my work validate me. I'm going to just keep going forward and ignore it. Because you know why? I ain't going to stop it anyhow. So why let it slow me down? Because guess what? As one famous person once wrote in a sacred text, haters gonna hate. I'm just gonna shake it off, okay? So I gotta put that aside and ignore the noise so I can do something great. How do great works get done? Number 10, celebrate progress over perfection. Celebrate progress over perfection. That wall was never the entire original old city. It was never the coolest architecture. No one had a picture of this wall. Like, we got to get a picture of that on our wall. Unless it was Nehemiah himself because he was proud, or his mama, you know, or somebody. But, I mean, like, nobody was going to, like, this was a hodgepodge. This was like, okay, build around this rubble and through this and redo that. And that doesn't matter. Who cares? We got to get a wall. And so many times in our lives, we don't make progress because we're trying to be perfect at every little thing. And our perfectionism stops us from moving forward. And I know we want to get the details right, but sometimes you just got to keep going. You can come back and do more later. You can come back and improve later, but you got to keep making progress. And you got to be able to celebrate instead of being discouraged. Oh, it's not perfect. No, just say, hey, we're getting somewhere. We're getting somewhere. And you got to encourage those around you. It's okay. We're getting somewhere. Celebrate progress over perfection. I just gave you 10 lessons that I did not make those up. They are from the book of Nehemiah's story, how great works get done. And I hope that somewhere in this room today, you didn't just hear another Bible story that maybe you did not know or you did know but are reminded about. I hope that somewhere today, someone who feels God has called you to do something important in your life, in your family, in some level, doesn't matter what scope or it is, that somewhere there was a principle or two or three that you're like, I needed that. And that's not just information, that's inspiration to help me do the thing that God has put me and inspired me to do. Because all of us can do whatever great thing God has for us. We'll start our last story next week. Let's pray.